and happy Independence Day to you. I am Cy Kellett, your host. This is Catholic Answers Live. And so if you're not listening in the United States, today is Independence Day in the United States, also called the 4th of July, because it happens on the 4th of July. Right. And so
even though it might have been the 3rd, it might have been the 2nd.
Right. John Adams thought it was the 2nd.
Yeah. But in any case.
We have this hour, our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, Norbertine priest and former prior of St. Michael's Abbey, here to discuss patriotism and love of country and all of those things here on the 4th of July. And I imagine the church has had a long time to reflect on a lot of things. She's probably had time to reflect on the proper love of country as well.
Absolutely.
So we won't be taking calls because we are pre-recording this so that I can be eating hot dogs with my feet up. And I don't know, Father, will you be back?
With all your women folk waiting on you.
Well, that's one. I have one woman folk, and I will see if she'll be waiting on me.
You're not doing any grilling yourself?
My brother's going to do it.
Okay.
Well, I'm not allowed near the grill when my brother's doing it.
Fine. Well, as long as you got people to work for you.
Well, I mean, I have to do some work.
That's the way our founding fathers were. You know, they had a lot of people to work for them.
That's true. They were men of leisure in many cases. They were industrious men of leisure.
Yes.
Father, patriotism. I want to start with this question because it seems topical to me. But you scoff if you must. But we hear all this recently, so much talk about nationalism. And to your mind, is there a difference between patriotism and nationalism? Are they two different things?
Well, they could be. I mean, they may mean the same thing to different people. But nationalism has the flavor of the 18th and 19th centuries, where people got, because of philosophical trends of the time, the notion that different ethnicities and nations have their own kind of genius that's proper to them alone.
Oh, okay.
And therefore, their national identity is kind of it becomes an ideology.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you see it like Americanism, you know, and you see this in Europe in the 19th century, where the different nationalisms were exalting the particular characteristics of their own particular country as unique and distinguishing, irreducibly distinguishing from other countries.
Yeah.
Now, that's rather different from the notion of patriotism, which is simply that you have the obligation, morally speaking, in justice, to honor and to serve those who have given you life and who have governed you in your life. And that's a different thing altogether. That is, so, for example, nationalists will say, you know, and we Americans do this all the time. We have the greatest nation on earth. There's never been a country greater than the United States. And we say that, right?
Right.
But that's not patriotism. I mean, you can say that if you want to. If that's your opinion, that you think that the United States is the greatest nation on earth, that's fine. You can have that opinion. But that's not precisely part of the virtue of patriotism. Patriotism is the considered love of the country which brought you to existence and took care of you and directed your life. And therefore, all human beings are bound in justice to love their own country as they love their parents and their ancestors and anyone who's done them good. And so it's not my country right or wrong. That is, you know, the Russian has the obligation to love Russia above every other country because Russia gave them birth and took care of them. And the same goes with Germans or Chinese or Japanese. Or this is the great tragedy behind a lot of wars, that we pretend when we have a war with someone that it's because their country is kind of evil.
Yes.
But right. No, the people that are fighting for a particular country, they have the obligation to honor and respect the country that gave them birth and direction. And so the patriotism doesn't involve or require the opinion that your country is better than any other. It does involve the notion that I have the obligation to love my country above every other country because it's mine. It's like you love your mother and your father more than any other people, anyone else's mother or father, because they're yours. They gave you existence and they took care of you and direct your life. And the connection between our parents and our And our fatherland is very close because the word patriotism comes from the word for father. It means, you know, we say the motherland, the fatherland. It's immediately related to our being brought to existence from a particular line of descent, you know, and that's where it begins. Now, there is a problem because, of course, we have a country which is largely populated by people whose ancestors came here without being born here.
Yeah.
And so the notion has to be expanded a little bit to go beyond simply physical descent. But, you know, when immigrants will tell you, you know, they came to this country and they got all the opportunities that they have to prosper and to have a good life and a better life. And they're grateful to this country because of what it offered them, like a parent, you know.
Yeah, right.
And so it's very much related to our reverence that is due to our parents in given to us in the Fourth Commandment. And so it's not the same thing as America's the best country in the world. It just means I love my mom more than I love any other person's mom.
Right.
Yeah.
America's an easy country to love, though. I don't know. It's a very lovable country. A lot of lovable people, beautiful places.
You know, many people in the world feel this way. They keep coming here.
Yeah.
And they keep wanting to live here.
But I imagine if I was Chinese, I don't know that much about the history of China, whether you feel loyal to your region more or their country as a whole or the civilization more or whatnot. But I imagine I would feel that way if I had been raised in China, that I would just, you love your people.
Of course.
You love your place.
Right. That's a natural question of human virtue and a sense of justice. Absolutely.
Now, at an earlier time in the history of the United States, people felt that love for their state in particular. It seems like we've lost some of that. Although, I mean, I feel out of a Californian. You know, I came here in kindergarten, so I feel like a Californian. And I do love the state of California. As crazy as it is,
were
I love
the state. Were you fleeing? Like they had to get you out of town?
Yeah, we were
kindergartner?
Yes, we were fleeing. The difficult kindergartens of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
But I love California too. But it seems like in an earlier time in American history, people loved their state. Like you think of like a guy like Robert E. Lee. He loved Virginia. Virginia mm-hmm. was his home. That was. Did they think about states more like countries then, or
back then? Yes. I mean that sort of was the driving force to a great degree behind the Civil War is that people's loyalties were local and the states were regarded as sovereign. Even now we talk about state sovereignty. So there was a time in this country, it's less now than before, it still exists to a certain degree, where people's principal devotion was to the state from which they came and not to the United States as a federal union.
Yeah.
But that was seen to be resolved in a certain sense by the war, but definitely that was the principal motivation that underlined the Civil War for sure, but that doesn't need to obscure the fact that we can view the question a little more broadly if we need to.
Mm-hmm.
Although certainly respect for the state of one's origin or where one lives is part of all of that, because most of the things we depend upon do come more from the state than from the federal government, but some things come from the federal government. But there's basically a sense that we have to have gratitude. You know, people complain about the crazy people running the country and how awful it is and whatnot, but then you go, well, all right, but even if you were in a communist dictatorship, all right,
yeah,
somebody's fixing the roads, somebody's making sure that the water flows in your pipes. Someone's making sure that the hospitals are open and whatnot. And as evil as these people might be from a certain point of view, they still do certain good things for the common good that you have to acknowledge. That's why Catholics are never hothead revolutionaries who just simply hate everything about their political opponents.
Well, I feel like we're getting there.
We're getting there pretty fast, but we shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Because the fact is that we need to remind those who rule us, whether we agree with them politically or not, that they still have certain key obligations to take care of the people committed to their care. That's a very important aspect. And to the extent to which they ignore that, it's a problem. Yeah.
Father Hugh Barber is our guest, and it being the fourth day of July, we're celebrating Independence Day with the discussion of love of country from a Catholic perspective with our chaplain. We'll continue that conversation right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
The reason people should listen is so they can get excited about the faith and then share that faith with others. Because that's what it's about when we say, Jesus says, come follow me, but he also said, go and make disciples. We'll give you the tools needed for the new evangelization. Because that's the call to bring everyone into a relationship with Jesus Christ.
Open Line with Father Larry Richards, tonight, 10 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
As the Declaration of Independence says, fourscore and seven. Wait, no, that's not the Declaration. It says, we the people.
That's the Constitution. What's the matter with you?
Just kidding.
You're faking it. Trying to act dumb.
It says
you don't do a very good
something
job of that.
About when in the course of human events. Okay, so like 200 and a bunch of years ago, there's this Declaration of Independence. And so we celebrate on the 4th of July. We call it the birth of the nation. Is that really, I mean, I don't want to be super technical about it, but is it quite right to say that's the birth of the nation? Or is...
Well, it's as good a point as any.
Okay.
Because, you know, what can you do? I mean, I always like to say, well, you know... If you really wanted to say, well, when did the United States become a nation in the full sense of the term, in terms of the law of nations, in which case you have, and I like to use this in homilies on 4th of July, which I am not preaching this year. It was the Treaty of Paris that ended hostilities between the English crown
and the
colonies. Mm-hmm. So, and that, which was, you know, The King of France took care of that, you know, to try to, broker that agreement. But that agreement begins in the name of the Holy and Undivided Trinity.
Does it really?
Right, and then it declares that the hostilities have ceased, and therefore the United States are going to be viewed as a sovereign nation. Among nations and so on and so forth. And the states gradually signed on, and there it was. And so I was like, well, the founding document of our country is not exactly, legally speaking, in terms of all the countries of the world.
Right, the one that...
It's that Treaty of Paris, and that begins in the name of the Holy and Undivided Trinity, which I always like that. So I just say, that's where we begin.
Okay, so the Catholic King of France has a big part to play in the...
Well, you know, they were kind of happy that the English were losing an enormous and wealthy colony of theirs. They
yes.
were very happy
right.
to stick it to the English, and they did.
Right. And they really got going with that a little bit later with the Napoleonic Wars. But so...
At that point, we weren't as enthusiastic about their tendencies, though.
No, was that probably the point at which George Washington said, stay out of it? I think
well,
was
this
that Washington?
That's the revolutionary mentality, you know, that followed. The Treaty of Paris, the revolution hadn't yet occurred, and so it was more moderate.
Right, right.
In tone, yeah.
Okay, so, but that does bring up a point I wanted to ask you about as we celebrate this Independence Day. As Catholics... We would not always have been overwhelmingly welcomed in the history of this country.
Well, of course, it would have gone state by state.
Okay.
And for the most part, I mean, the original 13 colonies were all Protestant in nature. And they most of them had established religions. They had state religions. That's why we have the constitutional norm that Congress will not establish any religion, because the states had the right to establish a state religion, but not the federal government. And then gradually the states relinquished that notion, even in their own behalf, you know, mm-hmm. so that they didn't have. But in the beginning, the states had, you know, the Calvinist religion, the Congregationalist, was established in Massachusetts and Maine and places like that. And the Anglican religion was established in Virginia and the Carolinas and Georgia. And so that there were, and then, but then the one state that was friendly to Catholics from the beginning was Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. That was founded by Quakers, and they believed in toleration.
Yeah,
William Penn, and so Catholics were always granted civil freedom there. But that's about the only place. Even Maryland is a little brief little window, and then it was over. So, yes, the beginning, but that's because the English-speaking world, generally speaking, I mean, in England itself at this time, Catholicism was illegal.
Yeah. Okay. So when was it that Catholicism became legal again?
It was actually the complete emancipation of Catholics only occurred in the early 19th century.
Okay. So we're still a ways off.
We're still a ways off from that. But what happened, and this is one of the things that's in the Declaration of Independence, the one of the grievances of the founding fathers were the terms of England's annexation of Quebec.
Yes.
It's not spelled out there, but one of the issues was the English allowed the Catholic Church full freedom in Quebec. They had to, because it's
what are you going to do?
Right. But our people objected, like, what are you going to allow these papists? You're going to have a whole province
right on our doorstep.
To the north. Yeah. Unless it's nothing but Roman Catholics, it's impossible, you know?
Yeah.
And that was a grievance at the time. So liberty for Catholics came very slowly and cautiously, but it did finally win the day, but it wasn't easy to begin with.
Was there a sense, do you think, among the founders of this country and just in the general thinking about democracy, some of it coming from Enlightenment figures, some of it coming from figures outside the Enlightenment, was that really the Catholic Church was the opponent to this new way of thinking about government? I mean, like the French Enlightenment thinkers, like Rousseau and Voltaire, they saw the Catholic Church as the enemy of the advance of new forms of government.
But
right?
They weren't involved in the French position regarding the American Revolution. They were.
Yeah.
They kind of come later in that regard. But there's some sense of that. But basically, even the most Enlightenment identified, you might say, thinkers like Jefferson or even Washington, they had a very benign attitude towards Catholics.
They did.
Yeah, because they viewed them as like a persecuted minority in the English system, and they also related it a bit to the Irish question. And so they had mild views towards the civil liberties of Catholics, but that wasn't true of everyone, not even at all, not slightly. And so as I say, there was on the elite level in this country in the beginning, there was a certain openness to Catholic identity. These are people that had traveled, been around. You know, Jefferson they'd all been to Paris and everywhere, right?
Right.
And although they viewed it with a certain attitude of toleration, you could say. But
in David McCullough's book on John Adams, mm-hmm. he has a very, I think, very funny recollection of John Adams going to Mass mm-hmm. and recalling for himself this stern New England Protestant guy, and he thought it was designed to beguile. He thought that's what with the music and the visuals and the smells and everything. He said it's designed to. I don't know if he would use the word bewitch, but you got that sense that that's what Adams thought of Catholic
liturgy.
Yeah,
well, that would have been. But if you went to a whitewashed, you know, Calvinist meeting house in New England,
would have been the opposite.
You know, it was nothing beguiling about that.
No,
you know, you're going to get some halfway decent hymns, but only from Psalms, not from anything else, and then a really hardcore homily.
Man, you would have,
yeah.
Okay,
and a guy popping you on the head if you fell asleep.
So. The suspicion of Catholics, though, also even all the way up until the time of John Kennedy, where I believe this accusation was repeated quite a bit during the election of 1960, was that really Catholic loyalties are split.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, he had the famous meeting with the Methodist ministers from Texas,
right,
and assured them that he would not let that happen. It was kind of pathetic, actually. But I would say the problem is it's not really about Catholicism being inimical to American notions of religious freedom. It's the fact that the Protestants in this country regarded their religion as the true one upon which this nation was founded. And so they oppose Catholicism simply because it's Catholicism. I think that's really more like it.
It's not rooted in some suspicion, really, that Americans' loyalties are in the Vatican. That Catholics' loyalties are in the Vatican. It's more like we just really don't want Catholics around here at all. Is that what you're saying?
Well, or that we suspect their religion doesn't allow them to be true Americans because true Americans are Protestants.
Well, that's the nature of the thing. And
right.
So, right, it can't
that's,
be.
That's sort of the view. And I don't think it was really anything other than that. But it was something that was perfectly acceptable to hold for the longest time. And even now, there's still some elements of it.
Well, in your reading of history, as I said, John Kennedy, you think of, what's his name? Smith, Al Smith.
Al Smith in the 30s. Yeah.
Yeah. They face these critiques. Would you agree with the idea that really it was the, First World War, but primarily the Second World War that solidified Catholics' position in America as clearly loyal, because they provided such service in those times?
Could be. I've never thought of it that way exactly. I think that the enormous numbers of Catholic immigrants and a Catholic urban Catholic culture and then an agrarian Catholic culture in the Midwest made it so that it was no longer reasonable or prudent to question Catholics' loyalty because they were so much a part of the country. I mean, basically, numbers finished the question.
Yeah, I
and
see
of course,
what you mean.
The Catholic immigrants that we had at the time were ones who assimilated very quickly into the system and contributed to the economy in a dramatic way, and did not bring the disputes of their home countries over here, which is a very important aspect. I mean, they were all bygones or bygones. And that's the great accomplishment, say, of something like the Louisiana Purchase and other things in our history, where we got large amounts of territory, even from Catholic powers, so that we never had a repeat of European land wars here.
Right.
And if you imagine, if the French had not sold us, you know, that whole central part of the United States, we would have had English-French wars on our
on
our borders.
Yeah.
And the same with the Russians. If we hadn't bought it from them for nothing, Alaska and all that,
right,
we would see, you know, horrible discord. I mean, you would have had World War II, but it would have been over here.
Yeah.
But we were very fortunate in that the different polities and countries that had an interest in our country, they almost by a historical miracle happily surrendered their territory for a price.
Yeah.
And so we didn't have to get involved here. We did it overseas. We helped them out where they live, but we never had it here.
Well, that's the American policy, really. We fight over there so we don't have to fight over here.
Yeah, that's the theory, yeah.
Unfortunately, it's a theory that's... But you remind me of Abraham Lincoln's quote that I'll paraphrase, where he said, "All the armies of the world assembled together couldn't combine to take one drink from the Ohio River." And in the 1860s, I mean, we're safe. Yeah. We have two oceans.
Right, exactly,
Okay, so we're talking with our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, a Norbertine priest, and as I said, the former prior of St. Michael's Abbey up the road from us in Orange County. And we're talking about the Catholic understanding of the proper love of country. Part of the reason I got asking you about Catholics is I wanted to ask about Does there become a point, or should we be concerned about this now, where Catholics feel actually not that their loyalties are split because they're looking over the ocean to the Vatican, but that they see their sense of being Americans as more important to them than being Catholics? That is, we've been, instead of transforming American culture into something Catholic, we transformed our Catholic faith into something American. And it's going to require more of an answer than you can give before
this,
the break.
This is a little problem. Yeah, some people, they arrive at Orthodox Catholicism because they began with political conservatism.
Oh, okay.
And that doesn't always lead in the right direction.
Fair enough. So we'll take a quick break and we'll talk a little bit more about love of country on this day when unabashedly we declare our love for our country and all its gifts given to us by the Lord, who gives so many good things. We'll be right back with more discussion after this.
This is Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Thank you again for being with us here on Catholic Answers Live on this Independence Day. Delighted to be with you. Hope you're getting to a little bit of relaxation. And maybe you're hearing us for the first time because you have a day off and this is not the usual time you get to listen to the radio or catch us online. And if that is the case, we're delighted in a special way to be able to say hello to you and welcome you. And if you want to find out more about us, you can go to Catholic.com and find out all about what we do at Catholic Answers. And there's a podcast of these of this broadcast, which will be available immediately. Well, I don't know, maybe not immediately. We might be on break, but pretty soon after the show airs. So you're always, maybe you could get it for your commute or something like that if this is not your usual time to be able to listen to the radio.
Remember also, that show airs is A-I-R-S, okay?
Just yes.
Keep that clear.
So when you're on, so when some other people are on, it's E-R-R-S.
It's A-I-R-S, the show airs.
So let me also make an invitation to you. If you're just catching us now and you don't usually get to catch us, we've only got a few spots left on our Rome pilgrimage. And if you've been thinking about making a pilgrimage to Rome, and this year might be the year to do it, November 4th through the 13th, we are going to Rome. We're staying downtown in the heart of Rome. And we're not getting on buses and traveling all over hither and yon. It's going to be relaxed and enlightening time in the Eternal City. Father Hugh will be our chaplain, celebrating Mass for us in the various churches and chapels around Rome, and also just enlightening us with spiritual direction and help as we go, and hearing your confession if you are so inclined. Again, I just want to invite you. I think we got a few spots left. So maybe three couples, maybe six singles if it goes that way. So you can find out all about it at CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com. CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com.
Very pleasant hotel, not very demanding.
No.
From that point of view, comfortable.
No, I think you and I have the same idea about Rome. Mm-hmm. We may have to convince other travelers that we're with, but we have the same idea about
it. Well, I lived there for 8 years, and of course I didn't live in a hotel, but still, it's a lovely place, and it's more beautiful now than it was when I was there, so.
It's more beautiful? Why? What are they doing?
They gussied it up, you know.
Did they?
A lot for the Holy Year and for different other events and whatnot, so it's much more beautiful than
it's
it was.
It's much better gussied than when it
they
was
They cleaned the facades and...
Uh-huh. What's that big thing to Victor Emmanuel, too? That's like, it dominates the whole city. What's that about?
That's a 19th century Freemasonic self-congratulation.
It's a big pat on the back.
So the Italian unification.
Oh, for Italian unification.
Like, oh, great. Now we have one country called Italy. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about that, because we're talking about patriotism today.
Perfect.
So I imagine probably the greatest thinker ever on the topic of patriotism was Thomas Aquinas, probably, because he's the greatest thinker ever on everything, right?
Absolutely.
Except for the theory of relativity. Or maybe not. Maybe he...
Oh. I can't comment on that. I imagine he would understand it if you explained it to him.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, yeah. Okay, so, like... I guess what I'm getting at is, so Thomas lives in the 13th century, the greatest century. That's what I call it, 13th
century.
That's
Walsh's book, yeah.
Does he call it the greatest century?
Yeah, William Thomas Walsh has the 13th, the greatest of centuries. It's a nice little book.
Oh, I got to get that.
It goes over philosophy, theology, art, music. It goes over all the different aspects of the culture.
But you know what? Even for common people, it was a great century.
He goes over everything.
So, okay, well, if you didn't have a favorite century before, now we put the 13th century in your mind as a possible favorite
century.
For you. Yeah, you know, it's up to your decision. It's your choice. But for me, the greatest century is the 13th century. But, okay, so this is before nation states as we know them now, right? So what would they be patriotic towards in those days?
Well, the nation states they didn't have, but they had the Christian continuation of the Roman Empire, which they took very seriously.
The Christian continuation of the Roman Empire. Okay, so the Holy Roman Empire.
Right, the so-called Holy Roman Empire. That's what they call it later. But they took for granted that society was governed by a polity, a political system, which had the emperor at the top and then the various local rulers associated with him going all the way down to your local earl or Duke or Baron,
right?
Who owned the land or governed the land that then you farmed, by some old right of your own family. It was a coherent system that functioned for centuries and centuries.
Yes.
But they didn't have precisely. This is the point. In the beginning, we talked about that. They didn't have the notion of nationalism. They had a notion of a social order that was centered on Rome as the head. Mm-hmm. And in the Christian world, Rome is the head both of the spiritual order and of the temporal order.
Right.
Now, usually the emperor at that point didn't live in Rome, although he had the title of Rome. He usually lived farther north.
He was a German most of the time.
Right. Well, I mean, but everyone was a German at that point.
Thomas Aquinas. Right? Thomas Aquinas is...
They're from Italy, but the... They were the Lombards and the German invaders.
Right.
I mean the pure Latin culture barely existed. No, it was gone. It was mixed up with everything else. And so so the emperor is either the Eastern Emperor in Constantinople or the Western one who's up north in Germany in Aachen or in some other place.
Yeah.
But it was regarded as a stable order, like a world order that was taken for granted. I mean, if you read the Divine Comedy, you see that it's just like, this is the way it is. This is the world that exists.
Uh-huh.
And government was an established thing, something like the movement of the planets and the stars. It's just, it was a stable reality. And they didn't have any notion of, they didn't have a notion of nation states. They had a strong notion of local identity, like my town's better than your town. They
right.
have that, you know.
Right, because we have the bones of Saint so-and-so.
My dad is stronger than your dad.
Yeah.
And so these local rivalries and everything, which could be very serious and even lead to little wars.
Yeah.
And you see that in Divine Comedy. Divine Comedy pretty much depicts the whole thing rather reasonably.
Uh-huh.
So that sort of thing existed. But what we would call nationalism nowadays, or the kind of patriotism that comes from that, didn't exist. That's why Italy's an interesting question, because Italy was not a country.
That's what I was thinking,
until the mid-19th century.
But it's a place.
And
it's
it was a deliberate attempt to unify all the different regions of Italy into a single country under a sovereign, a monarch, who was actually a French-Italian from Savoy.
Uh-huh.
And it's always the Northerners take over. That's the thing. The Northerners come and take over everything.
Right.
And that's what they did. And
Saying that as someone from North Carolina?
They had to do that. They had to obliterate the Papal States and get the Pope out of the way and do away with the kingdom of Naples, the two Sicilies, which was basically a French-Spanish enterprise, mostly Spanish, for a long time. People don't realize that Southern Italy was ruled by Spain for, you know, a couple centuries. So all these little principalities got eliminated, and they established a single country. And then they tried to work hard to establish a notion of an Italian national identity.
Right.
Which, that's the big problem in Italy, is that people don't really feel that much.
Right.
They are now, because they're reacting to mass immigration, and so they kind of talk about Italian identity.
Yeah.
But really and truly, you know, a Sicilian's a Sicilian. You know,
I have a friend who I called her Italian one time. She said, "No, I'm Sicilian."
And someone from the Veneto is from the Veneto, and they have Italian citizenship. But because Italy even has a whole province which is German speaking. You know, they have the South Tyrol, so they have a rather tenuous national identity. Similar things could be said about Spain, because they have these regions that are ethnically diverse, you know, the Galicians, the Catalonians, and all that. And so they have continuing problems with that local stuff. Probably the most patriotic, in a nationalistic sense, country in Europe would be France.
Oh, yes.
They centralized much sooner than anybody else. And so they have that notion down pretty strongly. They're little regionalisms, but nothing like you would find it. Germany was a bunch of principalities until the mid-19th century, you know, when the Prussians united the whole thing in a single Reich.
And what a beautiful place before the unification.
Yeah, they had hundreds of little... Now we see the remnants of it. You have Switzerland, you've got Liechtenstein, and you have Luxembourg.
Yeah.
You have a few tiny little islands of used to be.
So this is what I wanted to get to, a little bit about that. Okay, so there's a way in which nation states, it seems to me that America, after the founding of the United States, the image of America had an outsized effect on the world. And so in a lot of ways, there's even up to all the revolutions of 1849, mm-hmm. there's a kind of desire to imitate what had happened in America.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
it's not always to the benefit of the people who try to imitate it. It's not like we think about the British forming countries like Iraq, where it's not actually a country. They kind of stitched a lot of things together, or some of the African nations, which
Yugoslavia that's the most egregious example,
right? And so it seems to me that we've raised the nation state to this holy status that it doesn't necessarily need to have that.
Right, and now it's pretty much falling apart. We see that idea was definitely a strong one, especially in Europe. But in the States, it's different, because we didn't have an existing population on our continent.
Right.
We ourselves settled it and established communities there of diverse. I mean, look at Texas. Texas has whole, complete, authentic cowboy towns. Around Bandera and other places that are Polish.
I didn't know that.
And then they have other ones that are North German, the Wendish people and whatnot. They have lots of Central European ethnic groups that came to Texas, and they're honest to goodness Texans. I mean, I said mass a few times in a parish in Bandera, which had all Polish people. They had the hooks for the cowboy hats in the vestibule of the church,
uh-huh.
And these people were genuinely Texans,
right.
But they all had Polish surnames and were Polish Catholics. So we had so much land and so much expanse that these various communities could establish themselves without the feeling that they had to set up a new nation or a new territory for their own ethnicity.
Right.
They came just to be what they were, but not wanting to establish a little version of what they came from. So it's particularly interesting in that regard.
Yes, but I think part of what I also wanted to get to is this. Okay, so there's this idea, I think, afoot that you make these bigger and bigger nation states, and ultimately, I think many people, globalists have the idea, you ultimately just make the whole world one big system. And personally, maybe this comes from my Catholicism. I don't know. You can help me with it when we come back from the break. But it seems to me that going the opposite direction would be a better idea. Going back towards like the maritime republics of the late medieval period might be a better idea. But you know so much more about it than I do. I'll let you help me out when we come back right after this.
Okay. We'll just row our boat in that direction.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
And if you notice, there's Catholic bashing everywhere you go. They'll have a whole program about nuns who have gone astray. They're hungry for freedom. Why freedom? I got more freedom than all you have. I belong to the Lord God. I'm a spouse of Christ. Well, what can you give me? A car? Keep it.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. So happy to be with you on this 4th of July, this Independence Day. Hope you're enjoying it. Hope you're getting a little bit of time off. And I have the great pleasure of getting to spend this hour with our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber. And we're talking a bit about patriotism and love of country and proper love of country and doing a little bit of a historical survey. But all of that historical survey that we have done is to come to this point, Father, to ask you about... to get at the idea that as much as we love our country, loving the country is something that's I don't know if you say lower down or higher up than politics even. It's there's something more earthy about it. Love of country is like, as you said, like love of your family. It's
right, exactly.
And to lack love of country seems to me a terrible injustice.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the big problems we have now is that so many people, especially currently now, and on the left and the right, but especially on the left, they identify, they didn't even talk about love of country, but they identify sort of patriotism or politically, you know, acute ideas being woke. They always say that the woke people.
Right.
With ideology. And so there are people that are perfectly disposed to hate their ancestors because they didn't have the same exact political ideas that we have now.
Right.
And so you're not allowed to praise them and you're not allowed to love them. I mean, what happened with Biden. Biden just simply said, you know, it used to be, you know, we were able to get along even with horrible people like segregationists. Well, he was totally skewered for that.
Right.
It was a perfectly reasonable observation that there are some things we can get along with and do. We say the same things, you know, there's certain things that abortionist politicians might vote correctly on. And of course, you would ally yourselves with them. But you're not justifying abortion or anything because it's not the same issue because you're dealing with other issues. They're in the legislature. But they went crazy over him. And it was so unfair, you know.
Right.
And there is that tendency nowadays to just simply hate on anybody that disagrees with you on political questions, and ignore your bonds of nation and heritage and all of that with them. And this is making it harder and harder for Americans to get along.
Yeah, you can't, right, you can't hate it. Yeah, if you make everything about ideology, then the ideologically imperfect past means you can't love those people who gave you, they made this happen, those people who came before us. Okay, so the...
So if you say, well, they were slave owners, so I have to hate them. Well, then, you know, you're not going to take seriously anybody, practically, you know, more than half the people that,
right,
you know, to sign the Declaration of Independence. You have to be realistic. People are products of their own time, just as our parents were and our grandparents and just as we are.
Right.
And so we have to love them because they gave us existence and direction, even if they had faulty ideas sometimes.
Yeah. It seems to me that love of country, like you said, is you think of the country... which, you know, it's history, it's land, it's people, as your parent, as your mother or your father.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that the new modern way is to think of your country as like your child that you constantly need to scold and correct. And that seems to me we've got it backwards.
Yeah, or as an intrinsically always suspect of being oppressive.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
Is a distaste for parental and paternal authority. And so you're constantly demonizing the past because we've gone further. We have better ideas.
Yeah, we're better now, so we don't need
you. We don't need this, right?
People.
And so we pull down your statues and make fun of you. Or even...
Right.
And if someone even dares to say a peep in favor of them, like, well, Washington wasn't... Yeah, he had slaves, but he wasn't that bad a guy. Then you're already worse than he is at that point.
Right.
And people become irrational and therefore ungrateful for the country they have.
Right.
They alienate themselves from the very thing that they're supposed to be supporting. And that's that revolutionary, it's like that's the way Bolsheviks behaved.
Yeah.
That's the way like beady-eyed fanatic revolutionaries that were willing to slaughter people.
Yeah.
You know, and you see these Antifa types and whatnot, and you realize these people would kill us if they had permission, you know.
Yes.
It's just a question. You can see that the malice is so great.
Yeah.
And yet you go, well, where in the heck did you come from? You came from suburbia. Your parents were taxpayers and made sure you had everything you ever needed. And then they behave as though they were just simply oppressed and abused.
Right.
And it's just, it's a very sick mentality. That's why patriotism needs to be...
Most revolutionaries come from the middle class.
Of course.
It's not a lower class phenomenon. It's not the poor that become revolutionaries.
The poor need to survive.
Right.
They don't have time to go across the world and fight for the
It's the Che Guevara's who just
right.
can't
they
get
went,
over.
They all went to Jesuit high schools.
Yeah.
And there were rich kids, you know, down there.
Right.
The Castro and all those people, they're very, you know, they were coddled.
Yeah, right.
And then they get to put a rifle in their hand, and there you go.
They have their self-esteem is too high, I think. So, as that having been said, that love of country is in a certain sense apolitical. It's not about the politics of your country. As a matter of fact, I can imagine, say, a dictator took over America. I would still love America. I would just feel a terrible sense of loss that she was suffering through this thing.
Right, but if you did, say we were under a dictatorship and someone attacked our country.
You'd still defend your country.
We would still defend a country, even if...
Right, that's a good point.
We have a horrible government. That's why the church doesn't burden people. Like in World War II, the church didn't forbid people to fight for the Soviet Union because it was communist, or forbid people to fight for Germany because they had a Nazi in charge of their government, even though most of them were not Nazis. But, you know, the church doesn't deal that way because these political questions between nations are very complicated.
Yeah.
And your basic motivation is you have an obligation to defend your country when it's attacked.
Yeah.
Justly or unjustly, you can't lay down your arms if someone's like, you know, blowing up your neighborhood.
Right.
You know, and so.
Right. And so the soldier, you know, in America, we say soldier, sailor, airman, and marine. But you know what I mean? The military person who takes up arm in defense of the country does a very good thing, does a very and it would.
even
it's,
if
it's not
the
a political act.
Even if the government is not admirable. See, this is right. the thing. If people don't understand yeah. that we our people, they shouldn't join the armed forces because they agree with the politics of the government.
Right.
They should join it because they want legitimately to defend the safety and the freedom of the country of which they are citizens. Or not, even if right. they're not citizens, they can still be in the army. But that's the motivation. It's a patriotic motivation. It's not an ideological one.
Do you see any? It doesn't look to me like it's going to end well. All this Antifa stuff and all this, the just unbelievable amounts of anger that we all have towards one another. Do you have a remedy for that on this 4th of July? I mean, I suppose have a beer, sit and relax for a minute. Maybe the anger will pass.
Well, I do think that friendship is a very strong remedy for these things.
Okay,
but for that, people need to put away their social media and start relating to individual human beings instead of just demonizing people and on their Twitters and their. I mean, it's just there's a very shallow level of interaction, which allows people to demonize other people very easily.
That's a very
and
good
you can
point.
See that with our president. I mean, he demonizes people very easily in these little tweets and whatnot.
Right.
But then on the other hand, you know, like with Kim Jong-un or someone like that, when there's a personal connection, yeah. he has a very old-fashioned attitude. It's like, well, you know, I met the guy and he seemed like a nice guy
and now we're
going to make this work and we're pals.
Yeah.
You know, but that's an old-fashioned view that where his ideas don't matter. I mean, he's not saying I tried to convince him that communism is wrong. He's saying we're trying to come to an agreement because we can manage to do that.
Right.
And I think that sort of old-fashioned approach would be good with our neighbors as well.
Yeah, and not only doing business with people who agree with us politically, and not only it becomes it's like we're eating our own civility when we do that.
Yeah,
we're eating
yeah.
our society, and it's poisonous.
Right, and
that's a mix of metaphors.
You can't have the boycott mentality because you can't live in the world if you're constantly checking the political positions of every business you enter into. You know, you can't. You have the freedom to do whatever you want, but you know we have to live. You know, so I don't go around telling people don't buy your coffee at X place.
Yeah.
Because they are pro-abortion or pro-gay marriage. You can do that if you want, but I mean, the fact is we have a society now where those are pretty common positions, and you almost can't buy anything anywhere without being remotely associated with these evils, you know, because that's the kind of society we live in.
Right.
You know, you can't pay your taxes, so you have to be without being associated with it. So you have to be reasonable and sociable and try to bring people along in a friendly way and live in your neighborhood, you know.
Right. That's very well said. Live in your neighborhood, because
right.
so many people live inside their house or at work. You just get in the car and you go, but you don't live in the neighborhood. I like that. But okay, I had a question for you before. I teased it and I never got back to it, so I gotta get back to it before we go. How does a good Catholic be a good American? Because And I want to be both. I want to be both a good Catholic and a good American. I don't want to be disloyal to my country, but I also don't want to be disloyal to my faith. So how do I do that? Do you see what I'm... this is related to that question I had for you earlier about have we become so assimilated as Americans that we're not standing out as Catholics anymore?
Well, I think you have to be clear that your religious beliefs and your adherence to the Catholic faith is not based upon the church's or the hierarchy's adherence to your particular political opinions as an American. So that's one thing, so that you're not scandalized or disedified if you've discovered that the Pope or the hierarchy don't agree with your political choice as an American. You'd have to say, well, that's what it is, and recognize that the Catholic faith has to do with revealed truths that are revealed by God, who cannot deceive or be deceived. They're not about passing political judgments that can change from year to year.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's a question of just being a faithful member of your own family. That's never contrary to the Catholic faith, nor is it to be a faithful citizen of a country.
You know? Well, there's the music. May we have your blessing, Father?
Certainly. Benedictio Dei Omnipotentis, Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti, descendit super vos, et maniat semper.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you very much, Father. Happy 4th of July. I mean, happy Independence Day.
That's right. We like that better.
We like that better than 4th of July. Mm-hmm. Sounds less French Revolution-y. Thank you so much for joining us this hour. We got another hour of great programming coming up right after this. We'll see you then.